Ladies and gentlemen, our speaker tonight, Dr. Bob Hancock, so Robert Hancock, is one of our own here at UBC. He's really a UBC star who studies the intricate interface between microbiology and immunology, a place where cell membranes and molecular particles hold sway. He's professor of microbiology at UBC and a Canada Research Chairholder. He was the founding scientific director of the Canadian Bacterial Diseases Network and now heads UBC's Center for Microbial Disease Research. He's won many significant awards, ones that I'll include tonight among many, and there are lots that I've left out. But the first is the Canadian Society of Microbiologists Award in 1986, a fellowship in the Royal Society of Canada in 1994, the Canada 125 Silver Medal in 1995, MRC Distinguished Scientist 1995 to year 2000, the Jacob Biley Faculty Research Prize in the year 2000, and the BC Biotech Alliance Innovation and Achievement Award in 2001. And if those aren't enough, also his work was honored with induction as an officer of the Order of Canada in 2001. I think maybe we should congratulate Bob. Star, all right. Bob Hancock has published more than 300 papers and reviews and has had 12 patents awarded to him. His research interests include antibiotic uptake and resistance, functional genomics, and the development of small cationic peptides as novel antimicrobials. Tonight, Bob will draw on his special expertise to talk about new approaches in treating infection. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Bob Hancock.
Thank you. Whenever anybody gives an introduction like that, I wonder if they're talking about me. Because I don't seem to recognize all that, myself in all that. I'm actually really just a normal person, honestly. And I'd like to talk today, to you about something that is a subject that should be interesting to you, because it represents a threat that is probably the biggest threat, I think, to medicine in our society. But it also represents a promise. So I'm going to not give you a tale full of gloom and doom, but I'm going to give you a little bit of a feeling for this particular topic, new approaches to treating infections. And just to start off with a quote from Hiroshi Nakajima, the Director General of the World Health Organization, we're standing on the brink of a global crisis in infectious diseases. This kind of statement has been mirrored by politicians worldwide, and people are recognizing that there is a serious issue with infectious diseases. One of the issues is with the bacterium HIV, the virus HIV, which causes the disease AIDS. However, this is actually, relatively speaking, a fairly modest problem. And a more important problem is antibiotic resistance. As you can see from this graph, I don't have a proper pointer, by the way, so I'm just like, you just have to look at it and imagine I'm pointing, if you like. So there's a pointer in the drawer, but it doesn't work. This is why UBC needs your donations. And honestly, Indira doesn't care, but she didn't tell me to say that right. So here you see the prevalence of organisms called superbugs. And there are two major bacteria that have achieved the designation or status of superbugs. These are methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus and vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus. MRSA is a bacterium that is found commonly in hospitals, and this represents the incidence of Staphylococcus aureus infections in hospitals that are resistant to methicillin. Now, the implication of this is that there's just one bacterium, there's just one antibiotic that is capable of defeating this bacterium, vancomycin. And the V for vancomycin is part of VRE, vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus, which is a bacterium for which there really are no really effective antibiotics at this stage. And so you can see the trend of these graphs is upwards. So I'm going to tell you a bit about resistance, and I'm going to lead you through in a sort of a historical sense through antibiotic resistance. And then I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the approaches to designing new treatments for these diseases, some of which I've been involved with and some of which I haven't. Okay, so this particular gentleman, Alexander Fleming, made a really interesting observation, which is that he found that a particular plate that he'd been working on, that he picked up some weeks after he'd been working on it, had grown a fungus. And this fungus had spread, had somehow managed to kill all of the bacteria on the plate in its vicinity. And from this, he discovered the antibiotic penicillin. So this is the sort of experiment where you see in that figure indicated A there, that the fungus would be the thing in the middle, and there would be a zone of clearing where all the bacteria had been cleared away. And on the right-hand side, you see the impact of this as a result of his discovery in 1929 and a huge effort around World War II. We managed to develop the first antibiotic penicillin. It works really hell on here, my hand. Actually, I'm going to sell a pointer. What am I bid? Okay. So, we started to see posters pop up. Thanks to penicillin, he will come home. Well, if we start to look at the development of antibiotics, you'll see that with the discovery of penicillin around 1928, there was a flurry of activity discovering new antibiotics, largely from soil samples, and these were from organisms in the soil that were producing these antibiotics as mechanisms of competition in the soil. So we were able to acquire those, but you'll equally see that there's a massive gap after 1962, when the quinolones and vancomycin were introduced into medical practice, where we saw no new class of antibiotics. And for a considerable portion of the last 30 or 40 years, we've seen what we call me-too drugs, which are drugs that have been basically chemically modified by pharmaceutical companies to tweak their activities. The problems with these new me-too type of drugs is that the mechanism of resistance that bacteria evolve in order to become resistant to them are the same basic mechanism as they originally became resistant to these first antibiotics that were discovered. And so bacteria are increasingly getting better and better at learning how to become resistant to the me-too drugs. And in fact, until 2 years ago, there were no new classes of antibiotics discovered on that had hit the market in nearly in over 30 years. And we saw one, linezolid, which I'll talk about later on. Not an optimal antibiotic, but nevertheless an antibiotic. So what do antibiotics do? Well, they do a lot of different things. They attack bits of the cellular machinery. The easiest one to visualize is penicillin, which can act on a bacterial cell like E. coli here and tear big holes in it. So this destruction of bacteria is a very effective activity. So this is actually the original plate that Fleming isolated. And if Fleming hadn't been a very careful man, he never would have made this discovery. He was careful, but he was a great observer. And he just had this huge pile of plates lying around that he decided he'd go back and look at. And he plated out Staphylococcus aureus on these plates. And he went back and looked at them, and he saw this. Now, if I saw this in my lab, I'd say, ooh, look at that big globby mold, and toss it away. But he saw, look at that mold, and there seems to be an area of clearing where the colonies are not growing. However, the one thing that historians don't record that is very interesting is that within this zone of clearing, there are quite a few little dots you can see starting to grow up. And so when, at exactly the same time as antibiotics were discovered, antibiotic resistance was discovered. Those colonies are antibiotic-resistant organisms. So let's have a few facts about antibiotic resistance, some startling ones. In North America, every year, there are about 2 million hospital infections. 60 to 80,000 of these will go on to kill people. This is larger than the death, a lot larger than the deaths from HIV. There are 100,000 MRSA cases. This is this superbug that is only really treatable by one or two antibiotics. And although we haven't seen quite this incidence in Canada, there has been a six-fold increase in the rate of MRSA resistance from 1995 to 1999. Up to a half of all of the antibiotics are prescribed unnecessarily. So they're used for diseases for which antibiotics are not merited, particularly for viral diseases like colds and flus. Canada, perhaps because of our wonderful medical system, prescribes a lot more drugs than the US, two times as many, and half of the patients do not finish their course of antibiotics. And those last three points are really important because these have all been proven in careful studies to be things that tend to result in resistance development. Another factor is the use of antibiotics in animals. This gives you an example of an idea of the amounts of antibiotics that are used for animals, either for growth as growth hormones for animals or growth promoters for animals or as a prophylaxis or therapeutics for animals, as opposed to the amount used in humans. And for these, the major classes of antibiotics used in human beings, you can see that virtually all of them are used excessively in animals, if not predominantly in animals. And again, it's been proven that antibiotic resistance can move from bacteria that were developed resistance in animals into the human food chain and into human patients. So animal use of antibiotics contributes to resistance. What makes all of this a lot harder is even if we were to start a huge effort on the planet Earth right now to develop antibiotics, we would still have this hanging over us, which is the length of time it takes to develop and put an antibiotic into the clinic. So there are a variety of different phases of development. Each of these phases carries greater and greater risk so that the number of drugs you start with starts to diminish until you get through to the end of what's called phase three clinical trials and you start into government review of those trials and there's only one antibiotic out of 10,000 you started with. This makes this process now prohibitively expensive. It costs about $500 million to develop one drug, regardless of whether it's an antibiotic or any other type of drug. In fact, from what I know of the success rate or the hit rate for antibiotics, I think it's probably even more expensive to develop an antibiotic. I want to tell you a little bit about the only drug that has been introduced as a new class of antibiotics in the last 30 or 40 years. And this is Zyvox or linezolid. It's the first of a new class of antibiotics called the oxazolidones. And you can see in that picture the actual chemical structure. You can copy that down and there'll be a short exam after the lecture. So this is also the first drug in more than 40 years to be introduced for the treatment of MRSA infections. And it's reasonable but not perfect against vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus 2. The trouble is it has a few problems. Firstly, it is not an antibiotic that kills bacteria dead like penicillins do, but it's bacteriostatic. It stops them from growing. And this is thought to be a major contributor to resistance development. And in fact, there already is resistance. Secondly, there's a limited spectrum of activity. It's confined to a certain class of bacteria, so it's not a wonder drug or a panacea to all problems. And thirdly, there are toxicity issues, and it can cause myelosuppression. Another big problem is because it costs $500 million to develop this drug, the pharmaceutical companies, and they're basically at the end of that $500 million expenditure, there's 5 years of sales before it goes generic. Pharmaceutical companies have to sell these at huge prices in order to make any money. And the cost of Zyvox, or the linezolid, is over $1,000 United States dollars, real ones, right? Per course of treatment, as opposed to $30 to $90 for two of the really great antibiotics in our society, ciprofloxacin and amoxicillin. So this is a hard act to follow. Okay, there is a lot of antibiotics out there on the market, and they work against many infections. Generally speaking, when antibiotics work, they're tremendously effective. They clear out infections. Antibiotics stand between us and medical disaster. There's not a single modern medical treatment, surgery, transplantation, radiation therapy that could be utilized if it wasn't for the presence of antibiotics to kill infections. Antibiotics, by and large, are inexpensive unless you get to the things like Zyvox, which can be really expensive. They tend to be broad spectrum. They work against many, many different types of bacteria, unless, of course, you have resistance. Most of the time, they work. And this is, if you like, their great success, but it's their great failing because it's difficult to convince pharmaceutical companies to work on these things because most of the infections are treated. And when they think about the 2 million infections per year in North America that can be successfully treated and not the 60 to 80,000 that will result in death, so there's no treatment. And they have a great therapeutic index. That means the difference between the successful dose that kills a bacterium and the toxic dose that kills a human being is very, very large compared to a cancer drug where the therapeutic index may be 10 to 15. Because it's a hard act to follow, two of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world late last year, declared that they are no longer in the antibiotic development business. And Eli Lilly and Bristol Myers Squibb are two of the very original players in the game. Eli Lilly was part of the effort that developed penicillin in World War II. So this is a tremendous break from tradition for these companies. So what's the future? Now you're going to start getting slightly more positive messages, okay? The gloom's all happened, hopefully. Okay, so we're going to see increased resistance. There's no question. If you look at those graphs for the superbugs, they were all trending upwards. They're going to keep trending upwards. We're going to have to learn how to manage the antibiotics we have available, and that means education. And in this is an education that is not just required for students. It's required for patients. It's required for healthcare providers, for physicians, and for government officials who don't recognize this problem for what it is. We have to restrict the use of antibiotics in animals, and we have to have better diagnosis. We also have to start to think about new things we can do. So I'm going to tell you about four different things. I'm going to tell you a little bit about attempts in a more or less quasi-traditional way to develop new antibiotics. I'm going to tell you about novel strategies where instead of worrying about antibiotic resistance, we just hit the nail on the head and get rid of the resistance mechanism so that the antibiotic will work. It's not plagued by resistance. I'm going to talk about how if you start to look at nature, you can learn a lot of good stuff. And I'm also going to talk to you about entirely alternative approaches involving modulation of our immune response. So I'm going to start off talking about attempts to develop new antibiotics, and I'm going to talk about an area of genomics. And I have to warn you, I'm a scientist, right? So I'm going to tell you about some science because that's what I love passionately. And so I hope that at the end of this, if you don't love it passionately, you'll at least understand it. Genomics 101. Okay, so this is we're starting simple and we're going to get more complicated. So genomics 101, the genetic material in our body and in the body of a bacterium is called DNA. And that provides the inherited characteristics. DNA is divided into units called genes. They're contiguous units. So there may be a certain number of genes in any stretch of DNA. Each gene sequence leads to a unique protein because it has a unique sequence. And the DNA sequence will determine the inherited characteristics of an animal, which basically is the sum of all of the particular genes in the DNA. Genomics 101, second lesson, last pedantic thing, hopefully. And that is basically that the central dogma is that information passes from DNA, a double-stranded helical molecule, to RNA, to proteins. And All of the DNA in the cell is called the genome, which is at the bottom. All of the RNA species that are produced in a cell from all of the genes are called the transcriptome, and you'll never hear that again because it's a stupid term. And all of the, honestly, it was invented by genomicists who have nothing better to do with their time. And all of the proteins in the cell are called the proteome. So we now know what a genome is. Now we're ready to see what it looks like. Okay, so genomes have massive amounts of information. And this is a genome that my lab was involved in assisting the sequencing of. It's a genome from a bacterium called Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is a major pathogen in our society. And the deal is that there are 6,264,403, exactly 403, base pairs, each base being a unit of information in DNA. And this encodes 5,570 genes. And to see how complicated it is, if you look at that line that has the ticks going in both directions, each of those ticks represents one gene. And each of those genes has been carefully studied. You can explode the information from that and you learn a lot about each of those genes. So this turned out to be the largest bacterial genome sequence to date. In my lab, we actually host the web page, so if you can go to this website and you can just have oodles of fun with this, honestly. So it turns out, though, that sequencing DNA is pretty straightforward nowadays, and so there's an awful amount, large amount of information about pathogen genomes right now. And this is a list of all of the genomic agents that have either been sequenced or are being sequenced. And the little squiggly thing there, that's Helicobacter pylori, which, by the way, affects half the people on this planet, 2.5 billion people, and is a major cause of ulcers and gastric cancer. So all of these things have been done. So we have a lot of information. So getting more information, believe me, is not the high priority. Interpreting that information is really important. So I want to just give you a feel for how we would do this. So this is a genomic approach to finding a new antibiotic target. So it turns out if we look at all of the antibiotics in the world, there are about 20 or maybe 30 different targets in cells. That means gene products, proteins, that can be attacked by an antibiotic. That means if you have a bacterium like Pseudomonas with 5,570 genes, there are 5,540 potential new targets. Okay, so that's a lot of stuff, right? So we have to figure out which one of these 5,540 targets is a good target, and then we can start to devise methods of inhibiting that particular target. So the best antibiotic targets are ones that are essential. In other words, if we hit that target, we'll kill the cell. If we inhibit that particular protein, we'll kill the cell. We also want it to be essential in many bacteria, so we want it to be present in many different bacteria, all the ones that were on the previous list. And we want it to be easily accessible because getting the antibiotic to the target is a really difficult thing in the antibiotics game. So one of the methods that we use is a method called knocking out genes. And I'm going to give you this in a fairly simple version, if you like, but I can discuss the more complicated version with you later. So the idea is that we take a stretch of DNA. Now here we've blown up this part of the Pseudomonas genome, so you see five of the genes. And the idea is we put in a whole bunch of mutations and we make a library. And each member of this library will have a single mutation in it that knocks out the function of the gene. And how we do this, we actually insert a new stretch of DNA inside the gene that interrupts the gene. So this little pink arrow here represents one mutation that is in one mutant in a very large library. Now if we sequence thousands and thousands and thousands of mutants, which is dead easy stuff for sequencing nowadays, then what we find is that we can knock out a whole bunch of genes and recover mutants. Obviously, if you can knock out the function of a gene and recover a mutant, that means that gene is not essential, right? Because the cell still grows. If you can't knock out that gene, then that means the gene has to be an essential gene because any knockout would kill the bacterial cell. So it turns out in this, A, B, and E are non-essential genes, and C and D are essential genes, and they are now prime targets for antibiotic intervention. So the second method that we can use is a method to define location, because we want to have the target somewhere where we can get easily at it with a chemical. So we use a technique called Fourier fusion technology, which allows us to define location. And it's based on the gene fusion of every gene in the genome to an enzyme called alkaline phosphatase. So alkaline phosphatase is an enzyme that has to be exported out of the cell in order to work. So it has to be carried out of the cell by the rest of the gene that it's inserted to. So this is a method of tagging protein targets to reveal which ones are easily accessible. So the general idea is that we fuse the gene to an enzyme that is only active when secreted. So here are a bunch of genes in different places, all of which are relatively easily accessible. And all we do is, using genetic tools, we can fuse alkaline phosphatase to them. And if we see activity of that alkaline phosphatase enzyme, we know that that is a protein that is on the surface of cells. And so it's, again, it's a prime target. I've decided not to go through the process of leading you how you can go from knowing which genes you want to inhibit to knowing how to inhibit those genes, but genetic technology has evolved to where this is getting more and more straightforward all the time. This is an example of the sorts of proteins that you find, and all of these the proteins on the cells, and you'll notice that some of them have gene names. That means we know those genes. Some of them don't have gene names. That means they're brand new targets that we never studied, we never looked at before. So here's unknown proteins that are now new potential targets for antibiotic intervention. So I'd now like to turn to my second topic, which is a different type of strategy. So the issue is we have antibiotics in our society that work really well against many bacteria, but there are some bacteria that are resistant. So what if we produce compounds that can knock out the resistance determinants? So here is one resistance determinant that is very common in bacteria. The antibiotic there is a beta-lactam type antibiotic, or a penicillin type antibiotic, if you will. Penicillins and beta-lactams are the most commonly used antibiotics in hospital medicine in our society. And the biggest barrier to the success of these is an enzyme produced by bacteria called beta-lactamase that chews the penicillin apart and destroys its function. So it also turns out that the most utilized strategy, anti-resistance strategy, is using something called a beta-lactamase inhibitor. And the beta-lactam is packaged, so that's what the plus means, together with a beta-lactamase inhibitor. And the sole purpose of that beta-lactamase inhibitor, got the sound effects there, that means that's working, right? So it doesn't work unless you get a sound effect. So the idea is that the beta-lactamase inhibitor knocks out the function of that beta-lactamase, so now the antibiotic is fully available to kill cells. And Augmentin there's a huge amount of this stuff sold every year, more than $1 billion worth. Okay, ciprofloxacin. This is one of the most wonderful antibiotics in our society. Even though it's a sort of a me-too drug, it was derived from the first quinolone, nalidixic acid, about 20 years ago. The reason it's so wonderful is it's orally available. That means you can take a pill. You don't have to go to a hospital and be stuck on an IV line or injected or whatever. It's orally available. It's extremely broad spectrum. It kills most bacteria, and it's highly effective. You've heard about it because of this bug, anthrax, which became a big scare scene. Believe me, don't worry too much about anthrax. There were only 20 cases in the United States and about 4 million cases of hysteria. Okay, so you might be much more worried about the 60 to 80,000 people who die from antibiotic resistance. However, that's why ciprofloxacin became in short supply, because everybody was buying it up like crazy and sticking it in their bunkers, waiting for a nuclear holocaust and bioterrorism at the same time. So the mechanisms of resistance to ciprofloxacin are very simple. One, target site mutations, which inhibit an enzyme called DNA gyrase that is involved in DNA synthesis in bacteria. So there's an enzyme, there's a mutation that will knock out the ability to bind ciprofloxacin, but will knock out the normal function in the bacterial cell. And the other mechanism is a mechanism called efflux, which I really like, and we do some stuff on this in my lab, so I'd like to tell you a bit about efflux if I can. So the take-home message from this slide will be that antibiotic efflux counteracts antibiotic uptake. And it's a very interesting mechanism because it's a mechanism that really is relatively nonspecific. A single resistance mechanism can affect many, many different classes of antibiotics. So in the upper panel on your left-hand side, you can see E. coli. And you see around the border of that, that's called the membrane, and this is a blow-up of the membrane. And you learn that it actually has two cell envelope membranes, an outer and cytoplasmic membrane. And the target for ciprofloxacin is going to be inside the cell below the board, okay? So you're going to have to get across both these membranes if you want to do that. So there are two features that you really need to know about. One is porins, which are proteins that form water-filled channels that allow the ciprofloxacin to float inside the cell. And the second is that fancy apparatus, which is called a R&D efflux system, which involves three different components that span all the way across the membrane. The outermost component is a really neat-looking protein that spans all the way across the cell. And I just want to tell you, we know a lot about this protein, so it's a great potential target for us. And the deal is that an antibiotic is taken up into the cell through the porins, and then as a result of efflux, it's spat back out into the medium. So the antibiotic never gets into the cell to attack its targets. And this particular mechanism is relatively substrate nonspecific. It's relatively antibiotic nonspecific. So the same resistance mechanism will affect many different types of antibiotics. So the solution is that if we could block this method of efflux of antibiotics, we'd reverse resistance. And there we go, we managed to do it. And what we generally speaking do is we use analogs of exactly the same antibiotics that are usually spat out that now block efflux. Okay, so I'd like to move to my third topic, which is learning from nature. So nature is a wonderful thing, basically. It provides us with many marvels, but only in the last 10 to 15 years have we started to understand that nature itself produces antibiotics. And it produces antibiotics in the form of these proteins that you can see arrayed here across the slide, which are called peptides or protein-like molecules, and they're called cationic antimicrobial peptides. So it turns out that even though these are very recently understood, it's now recognized that these are the major defense mechanism present in bacteria, insects, and plants, and that they're very important components of local defenses in man, mammals, fish, birds, amphibians, and crustaceans. I just want to give you one story about how these were discovered in amphibians, in frogs. A guy named Mike Zasloff was doing these experiments where he was doing surgery on frogs, just like we used to do in high school and stuff. And after he was doing this, he'd suture up the frogs. I don't know, he's tearing out organs or some, you know, nice thing like that. And he'd throw them back into the pond. And obviously, frogs don't live in the best, most hygienic conditions. They live in dirty, murky water, and that's the way they like it, and they don't apologize to anyone. I mean, anything that looked like a frog would not be apologizing, right? So the deal is that Mike started to notice that when he made the incision to actually remove the organs he was removing, he started to see foaming that occurred at the site of the incision. And this foam actually was a protein foam, which was these molecules, peptides. And furthermore, when he threw the frog back in the murky tank, it did not become infected, despite the fact that there were lots of potential pathogens in that murky tank. So Mike realized that that foamy stuff was actually an antibacterial agent produced by the frog to kill bacteria in its rather unhygienic conditions, and that's how it kind of managed its life. Even if it got its legs ripped off by some avid Frenchman, it still could survive. So for us, these natural peptides have become wonderful tools as design templates for making improved synthetic peptide antibiotics. So we're learning from nature and we're improving a little bit. And this particular molecule, in fact, that is shown here is actually a molecule derived from a fusion of a moth peptides from Cecropia moths, silk moths, and a bee peptide from honeybees. So we can use those themes or many other different types of themes. So the great thing about doing design work with peptides is that the methods for doing structure on peptides are really very, very well developed. So we can learn a lot about structure. So there are 500 or so natural peptides now known, all sort of information that's come up in the last 10 to 15 years. And these peptides have many diverse structures, from the helical type of Cecropia-Melaton hybrid to the loop type of bactinasin structure to this sort of floppy thing from which is called indolicidin. And these molecules come from many different species. Defensins are found in humans and insects and plants. Indolicidins found in cattle, and Cecropia-Melaton hybrids are insect peptides, so they're from everywhere. So they provide lots of templates for starting off. So this is what they do. This is a nice E. coli cell. It's a scanning electron micrograph taken here at UBC, right? We have a very good EM facility. This is what happens when you now treat that cell with a cationic peptide. It develops a sort of a pox-like look, and those bacteria are dead. So that's a good thing, right? That's what we're trying to do. Excuse me. I got too fast with my finger there for a minute. Okay, so this is an example of the sorts of things that we can do. And I know this is sort of dry numbers, but there's a little message in this, okay? So this is a series of peptides derived from horseshoe crabs. Horseshoe crabs are a very ancient species of life on this planet. They've been unchanged for the last 500 million years or maybe more, I've forgotten. But something like that. So the idea is that these sorts of activities, minimal inhibitory concentrations, which is the least amount to kill a bacterium, are really quite low. And you can see that included in this are a list of bacteria, which include things like our MRSA. It includes Enterococcus faecalis, which is VRE. It includes many multi-resistant E. coli and Pseudomonas, etc. But unusually, antibiotics, the dogma is antibiotics only work against bacteria. They don't kill anything else. Well, nature has designed these molecules, these cationic peptides, to actually also kill fungi. And Candida albicans is the major medical fungus that is a problem in our society. And in addition, the same peptide can kill viruses. And this is, I know we're going into the realm of kind of science fiction now, but believe me, this is true. These things can kill viruses, bacteria, and fungi, the same molecule. And nature has designed a molecule that all of the pharmaceutical chemists on the planet were unable to do. So it's worth looking at nature. So on the right-hand side, you see a sort of a design effort, which wasn't tremendous. You can actually see that the activities are a little bit weaker. The inhibitory concentration is higher. But interestingly enough, when we take polyfamusin 1 and we try to save a mouse from an infection, it doesn't work at all. Whereas PV5, our variant, which has been patented, is owned by University of British Columbia and now actually is out at two pharmaceutical companies, it protects against bacterial infections and endotoxemia. I'll tell you what endotoxemia is. So the other nice thing about these peptides is the way they kill. So this is killing by conventional antibiotics, as you see. Ceftazidime is one of the most recent me-too beta-lactam antibiotics, and gentamicin is an aminoglycoside, a rather original one. And these kill relatively slowly at concentrations quite a bit above the minimum concentration to inhibit bacteria. In contrast, peptides like this one, CP29, can kill 5 or 6 log orders of magnitude of bacteria. So that's going from 100 million bacteria down to 1,000 bacteria in 5 minutes. They're incredibly potent, rapid killers of bacteria. So I want to tell you one slide where I'm going to show you how we design these things. So this is a natural peptide called bactinasin that forms this loop structure, and the loop's held together by a covalent bridge that bridges a couple of amino acids called cysteines. So each of those letters there is a single amino acid, and there are 12 letters, so there are 12 amino acids. They're cationic because the R letters have a positive electrical charge. So this molecule, bactinasin, is a natural molecule found in cattle and sheep. And you can see that it has modest activities against a variety of different bacteria, including, but really no activity against Staphylococcus aureus, which is MRSA, or Enterococcus, which is VRE. Okay, so the first thing we did is we said, what happens if that loop region is made one amino acid larger? And so we stuck a proline, a P, in the middle. Don't worry about what the amino acid is. And you can see that we very effectively totally mucked up all activity at all. Okay. So we tried a lot of other different amino acids, and one that works very well for us is this W, which is tryptophan. So if we put a tryptophan in this molecule, we now are starting to pick up pretty broad spectrum activity. And then we increase the cationic residues, the R residues, by putting two more R residues. And we now have a very potent broad spectrum antibiotic peptide that is able to kill many bacteria. So this is actually, we didn't do this logically in this sequence. We did hundreds of different variants, and this is retrospective wisdom, right? But this is how I would have designed it if I'd have been rational about the whole thing. Okay, so now I have to, I warn you, I'm now going to show you some animal model experiments, and I know some people don't like the concept of using animal models experiments, but if you're ever going to think about putting an antibiotic into a human being, you have to first make sure it works in a living species. So this is a relatively good model because it doesn't actually involve killing the living species, so I thought that would be okay. So the deal is that this is a rat, right? And the rat is we establish in that rat a chronic lung infection. And we do this because one of our major interests in the laboratory is studying cystic fibrosis, which is a major genetic disease that is plagued by chronic lung infections. And then we deliver to these rats peptides in an aerosol, a spray, and we see whether we can knock out the bacteria. And the answer is, I wouldn't be showing you this unless it was successful. So, wow, it works. 3 daily doses by aerosol have a phenomenal ability to knock out the number of bacteria in that rat lung in a very, very difficult model that is not easy to get this sort of effectiveness. So I'd just like to tell you some other properties of the cationic peptides. They're also kind of neat anti-resistance types of molecules. They are not affected by common clinical resistance mechanisms. So MRSA and VRE don't affect their activities, for example, or multi-drug beta-lactamases won't affect their activities. It's very difficult to select resistant mutants, and they seem to show synergy with conventional antibiotics, so they work hand in hand with conventional antibiotics, especially against resistant mutants. These ones have been actually licensed out by UBC to a company that's a Vancouver company growing just off campus, Micrologix Biotech Inc. Micrologix have taken peptides that look rather like the one over on the left-hand side there, NBI-226, into phase 3 clinical trials to prevent catheter-associated infections, which is a major problem in antibiotic resistance infections. And there have been estimated to be between 250,000 and 400,000 of these infections every year, because as people have catheters inserted through their skin, they pick up bacteria and then they tend to become colonized. And the colonized catheters tend to seed infections in the rest of the body. So it's a good area. And the FDA believes that there's some hope in this particular approach because they've fast-tracked it, which with the FDA means that they're going to get through their bureaucracy in 2 months instead of 2 years. And they only do this when these molecules access an unmet need and there's evidence that they may work. So I'm very hopeful this trial will actually be resolved halfway through the year that this will come to something. And no, I don't own Micrologic, so this is not an advertisement. If you want to buy shares, cool. If you don't, cool. Okay, so I'd like to now talk to you about my last theme, which is now moving away from the whole idea of antibiotics, things that actually inhibit bacteria, to things that tickle the host. And I'd like to talk to you about the general, a simple experiment that indicates that if we could work on a system in our body called innate immunity, and we could upgrade that particular system, this would allow us to protect against infection. So in the green circles, you see the timing of what's known as the primary immune response, which is the antibody response in a mouse. And you can see that this antibody response doesn't kick in for about 3 to 5 days, and it doesn't reach a maximum until about 15 days. It's pretty slow. Okay, and it's slow especially when you consider those red squares, which is what happens when you put a high dose of bacteria into those same mice. You see that they die very rapidly in a couple of days. In contrast, if you stick a lower dose, in fact it only has to be about fivefold lower, then you see the yellow diamonds, which is no killing at all of the mice. And what has protected those mice against killing is innate immune mechanisms of our natural immune system that allow us to basically kill bacteria that we're exposed to. And the objective would be to try to boost this innate immune system so it can now take care of fivefold more bacteria, and then that red line would be back down on the baseline. Nobody would be killed. So I need to tell you a little bit about innate immunity. Every day of our lives, yes, even in this lecture theatre, we are encountering microbes, pathogens. We encounter them in the air we breathe. And when this person coughed, we encountered a few more. And we encounter them in the food we eat and drink. So when you had dinner before you came here, you encountered a few more microbes. We encounter them when we kiss the children or the pets, if you're into kissing pets. And so we're exposed to thousands of potential pathogens. And so we have to have a system available to us that will stop those potential pathogens from going on to cause infection. And by the way, there's no amount of scrubbing, cleaning the bench or whatever that's going to rid bacteria from your environment. So don't even think about it. Okay. Organisms have a tremendously effective method of dealing with pathogens. It's called innate immunity. And only recently, I think in the last 5 years, have we started to really appreciate the significance of this mechanism as a surveillance mechanism that recognizes all these pathogens we encounter and deals with them before they get to cause an infection. Acquired immunity, as I already mentioned, things like antibodies and T cells and B cells and stuff like that, is not engaged for several days after initial infection, so it's not going to work against those chance encounters. What we've been able to find is these same elements we were talking about from nature have actually served a function apart from their killing function, and that is an ability to influence and upgrade some of the elements of innate immunity. This is totally independent of their antibiotic activity, and we've termed these molecules enhancers of innate immunity, cute name, eh? And because I really believe in this, together with a colleague of mine, we've started a company, which is this little one in the thing. It's all the time in a mention of that. And you've never heard of this, and you won't for a long time. It's a private company that has no money. So, you know, it's even more impoverished than most biotech companies, right? So this gives you a feeling for how we've been able to gather some of these data. So this uses a technique called, this is like high quality genomic type stuff, right? It uses a technique called microarray analysis. And a microarray analysis probes for which genes are turned on in a given cell. So what you'll see is in many different locations, you'll see pairs of spots, okay? So these are the ones that gave a positive response, but equally spaced all the way around, there's 500 pairs of spots on that grid. So a lot of genes that are represented by those spots didn't give, were not active in the cell. They were not turned on. So each pair of spots represents the binding of a specific labeled messenger RNA, which remember is that intermediate between protein, between DNA and proteins, from a particular gene, and therefore records the expression of that particular gene. So if the spots are really dark, that means that particular gene's turned on a lot, and if the spots are really light, it's turned on a little bit. And what happens is when we take a cell, this would be a human epithelial cell, and we throw in our enhancer peptide, we see upregulation of some peptides that are ringed by little circles there. And in fact, here's some data. So this is a bunch of different genes. I took out the names because I thought they'd just be like distracting, but we know what the names are. But you can see that the fold upregulation by these enhancers can be 20-fold or more within 4 hours. So it's very rapid turn on of a system that needs to be engaged very rapidly to deal with bacteria. Okay, so a major element that is influenced by these particular, that is important in innate immunity and is influenced by these particular genes that are turned up is this, which is called a phagocytic cell. So phagocytic cells that are called either macrophages if they're tissue cells or neutrophils if they're blood cells are these cells that basically throw out these long prostheses and grab hold of bacteria, draw them into their body, suck them in, and then basically kill them. And interestingly enough, one of the major mechanisms inside the macrophage for killing is cationic peptides themselves that are present inside these phagocytic cells. So in order for these phagocytic cells to function, they have to get to the site of infection. So one of the things that is turned on in terms of the classes of genes by our enhancers is a set of molecules called chemokines and chemokine receptors, and they draw phagocytic cells into the infection site. And I'll show you this in a little bit more detail in a minute. And so the effect that these have is boosting our innate immunity because they increase the ability to recruit cells that are necessary to deal with infections. In addition, we found another very interesting set of genes that are what called anti-inflammatory genes that dampen down inflammation. And you'll see that that's really important too in human medicine. So they reduce inflammation and sepsis. So I'm going to show you a little bit of like data that's from in vivo situations that kind of explains how these things work. So here we are boosting innate immunity. And this is now done in whole human blood. This human blood came from volunteers, which around my lab means graduate students. So, and honestly, they all, in fact, some of them are sitting up in the back there, so, you know, they'll probably volunteer if you want blood now, you know, because they're really nice people. So the deal is this is now in whole human blood of these volunteers. Basically, we added or didn't add peptide, and you can see a massive upregulation of MCP1, which is a molecule that attracts in macrophages, and IL-8, which is a molecule that attracts in neutrophils. And to give you an example of what's happening, I showed the panel there that's going to have a little bit of action happening. So the idea is chemokines attract phagocytic cells involved in innate immunity. So those pink bacteria, right, are present in a tissue, and that's a red blood vessel there. Peptides will be produced or found in the site of infection, and they will basically spread out, so they'll form a concentration gradient towards the blood vessel. This attracts phagocytic cells towards that that are actually floating around in the blood vessel. The other name for phagocytic cells is white blood cells. These white blood cells are then attracted into the tissues by the gradient of peptide. Okay, that's because they have this attractive mechanism. And the phagocytic cells zap the bugs. Okay, cool. Okay, this also happens in a live animal. This is a mouse, we're looking at the production of the same chemokine MCP1 that you saw in the last slide in the lungs of mice that have had peptide dribbled down into their lungs. So you basically see upregulation of this chemokine that would attract phagocytic cells into that area. but you don't see any inflammation, TNF-alpha being a marker of inflammation, and that would be a bad thing. In addition, I told you that the peptides block a set of genes that inhibit inflammation. And inflammation and its associated phenomenon called sepsis are an extremely big deal in human medicine. Every year in North American hospitals, there are 640,000 cases of sepsis that occur. And these cases of sepsis lead to 120,000 deaths. Often the underlying cause of death is given as something else, like cancer or some other major ailment. But the actual contributor to death is this phenomenon of sepsis. And the way this can work is that you have a bacterium that is in your blood, and the physician will treat you with an antibiotic. When that happens, the antibiotic will kill the bacteria but will release the bacterial contents. And some of the parts of the bacterium are capable of causing this phenomenon of sepsis. And sepsis involves such things as an increase in temperature and a leakiness of blood vessels and multi-organ failure and death. So all of these are potential spin-offs of antibiotic therapy. The antibiotic worked, but unfortunately the patient died. This is a phenomenon that can occur. It's not good. So here's a mouse endotoxic shock model where we've given a certain dose of endotoxin and that kills the mice. And then when we add peptide back to those mice, we save the mice from death. So I've come sort of like to the end of my talk. I told you I was going to talk to you about discovering new antibiotics, and I basically told you about four different approaches. One approach was attacking resistance head-on, where we know what the problem is, so we try to just defeat the resistance mechanism to allow antibiotics we now have in our society to work. A second approach is to utilize this enormous store of information provided by genomics, and to try and manipulate that to find new antibiotic targets that allow us then to select brand new classes of antibiotics that kill cells in different ways. And interestingly, that method would now, when you had resistance, that would not be a resistance that would affect other antibiotics because that was a unique target. I told you about boosting innate immunity, which is a method of marshalling a person's normal defenses in order to try to make them work better and kill the infection. And I told you about learning from nature. So why haven't people been doing this stuff forever, right? I think part of the problem was that we had a fixed idea about how to raise antibiotics, how we were going to make new antibiotics. And from the very first time that Alexander Fleming looked at that particular plate and found that penicillium on the plate, which he found was a soil fungus. Pharmaceutical companies screened tens of thousands of millions or whatever different bits of soil and deep sea ocean refuse and plants and stuff to try to find new antibiotics, figuring out that somewhere around that if it worked for penicillin, it would work for everything else. So the approach worked really well up to 1962, and it didn't work at all from 1962 onwards, but pharmaceutical companies kept on with the same methodology. And so I really like this quote, which is by John Maynard Keynes, who said that the difficulty lies not in new ideas, but in escaping the old ones. Thank you very much for your attention.
Now open the floor for questions.
I was wondering if there's any future in screening soil samples for actinomyces or new possibilities for antibiotics. Like it's pretty well due to maximum.
Okay, so the question was, is there any future for screening soil samples for new actinomycetes for will produce new chemicals that will, or has this played out? Interestingly enough, there was a very interesting company formed on campus by a member of our department called TerraChem. And the concept there is that many organisms in the soil are unculturable. In other words, we've not figured out how to grow them in the laboratory environment. But they have the potential in them to produce chemicals we've never seen before. And we'd miss these because the way pharmaceutical companies have worked in their very traditional manner is just to use the same growth media to try and encourage bacteria in the soil to grow, or fungi or whatever, that will then produce new antibiotics. So there is some hope through that approach. Unfortunately, TerraChem was acquired by a company called Cubis and just closed shop at UBC. So this is a bad story of how Canada loses little companies, but it was a good story for a while. So I think there is some hope, yes. Okay, so I was asked, what do I expect for changes in the life expectancy in the next 5 years? Well, I'm not an insurance salesman, so I have to warn you about that. I think that we're okay for 5 years. I think that we're probably going to live pretty well the same life expectancy. If you look, though, at how much impact antibiotics have made on life expectancy in Western society, it seems like it's about 8 years. Dealing with microbes actually has had much bigger effect. It about doubled our lifespan between 1900 and 1940, and the reason for that is we learned how to live in a sort of hygienic environment, a more hygienic environment. We learned how to deal with water supply and sewage, etc., etc. So antibiotics alone added about 8 years to our life expectancy, but there's a huge potential for reversal of gains. If you look at the life expectancy of somebody in developing countries, it's half our life expectancy, and the major difference is infectious diseases. So the worst we can do is live half as long, but since I'm past there already, I don't really care that much. Yeah. So this is a tremendously attractive idea that people have pursued for quite a while. And there's a number of companies that have come up with some very ingenious approaches, and I used to consult with one of these down in the San Diego area. It's using an antisense RNA methodology to try to overcome. So the idea is that you use DNA basically can be complementary. That means it can bind to itself, and you can see that because DNA is a double helix. So that means if you have a strand of RNA, it's possible to form a complementary strand, just like a second DNA strand that will bind to that, and that would inhibit the RNA's ability to grow in cells. So the technique works tremendously in a test tube. You can actually inhibit quite adequately RNA production in a bacterium, in an in vitro system. It doesn't work so well when you go to a whole bacterium. And in fact, you have to start doing things like heat shock, which means you have to heat the bacterium to 60 degrees for 5 minutes, which you're probably not going to get away with in a patient. So the idea is that the actual methodology works in theory, but delivery of the technology into the bacterium is a real problem. The cationic peptides do bind to negatively charged biological molecules, virtually everything, from membranes to proteins to RNA and DNA. And in fact, the mechanism seems to be largely physical, so they're really acting by taking advantage of many things in nature being negatively charged, and they are the opposite positive charge, so they bind and inhibit. Because of that, we don't think we see resistance. In fact, we don't see resistance at all. But the actual specific target has not been decided upon at this stage. This guy right in the back there. Yeah, you.
Well, I was talking to Dr.
Okay, this was a hobby of mine for a while. I was trying to see whether I could affect this happening in Canada. And one of the reasons is because it's... the deal is that it's about recognizing the problem properly through proper surveillance in hospitals and sharing information between hospitals to allow you to deal with the problem most effectively. So I would say all of the statistics I showed you, you notice if you were very perceptive, they were all US statistics. The reason is we don't collect statistics properly in Canada for antibiotic resistance. In fact, we don't collect many medical statistics at all. Part of the problem is because hospitals that tend to use the same methodologies tend to have completely different computing systems that don't talk to each other. And it's not as easy as you think, because a hospital computing system has to have a layer of a firewall that protects patients' identity from the outside world. And so when you try to hook up hospitals, that firewall inhibits the ability to hook it up. So there's a lot of interest in trying to set up a proper surveillance network that allows us to develop information, collect it in a hospital, feed it into a common database with the patient's name removed to provide statistics, and at the same time provide a database for hospitals. But this would involve two hospitals talking to each other, which I understand from my medical colleagues is a virtual impossibility. So there we go. It's a good idea, but... Yes. Okay, so there are certain things we can do, okay? One of the difficulties with dealing with animal use of antibiotics is that there's such a strong lobby group in favor of this of use of these antibiotics. It's become part of traditional farming practice, kind of like, you know, building haystacks so they're round or something, you know, this sort of, it's that important. Interestingly, there have been studies done that have shown that the antibiotics that are used as growth promoters are unnecessary if the farm is kept in reasonably hygienic conditions. So it really makes no impact. But farmers are worried about the impact of not using those antibiotics. So that part of the problem I think we could deal with tomorrow just by banning growth promoters outright. And it's been done all through Europe, right? So if it can be done in Europe, why can't it be done in North America? We'd have to do it in Canada and the US. So the Canada and the US talk about as much as hospitals do to each other. So chances that we'll ever have a concerted form of action is probably low. But we could set an example here in Canada. Another concern, though, is antibiotics that are used for what's known as prophylaxis. So the deal is one of your animals gets sick, or farmer, you know, Joe next door or Jane next door's animal gets sick, and then you treat all your animals with antibiotics. And these are available freely in supply houses in the US. So farmers just drive across the border, grab a tub of antibiotic, and off they go. And this is a major concern because those antibiotics are usually human antibiotics. Some of the growth promoters are human cross-reactive, but those are usually human antibiotics or very close to them. And that, I think, really involves education of farmers. It's really difficult, though, for a farmer, say, in... you know, Edmonton or somewhere like that where it's freezing cold in winter and they have no access to a vet and their animal's sick, what are they going to do? So I have sympathy with the situation, but it's a situation that needs positive action but is stymied by the fact that the farm group is such an intensely active lobby group. You choose them. No, it's an interesting phenomenon. You can't really go back all the way. So what people have, what has been done is that especially individual hospitals and even individual countries like Iceland have completely rested the use, stopped the use of particular antibiotics where they have a big resistance problem. And they've directed all of the physicians in their aegis basically to use particular antibiotics. And when that happens, you do see a reduction in the rates of resistance. But when you start to use those antibiotics again, you see a rebound to the levels of resistance that are equivalent to whatever the usage is. So there's actually a really nice curve I saw in a Journal of Infectious Diseases where they showed a linear relationship between the amount of antibiotic used in a hospital and the percent resistance. You know, so the more you use, the more resistance you see. And even if you rest, eventually you'll see a rebound to previous rates. So there is no going completely back. We still have to manage the antibiotics we have. That's an important factor, but we also need a few more. Hi. Well, I tried to show you how long it takes, right? It's a long, long, long time. And I have to... Okay, so how long is it going to take to produce an antibiotic? So, and including, say, the antibiotics Micrologics producing. So Micrologics, it'll be fast. It'll be in this year because they've been fast-tracked. Most antibiotics are not fast-tracked. They're dealing with a very competitive market. So let's say I started to do research. I had a really good idea today. I think it'd be 5 years in my lab before it went into industry, and then we'd start on that cycle that I showed you, 15 years to get to the clinic. We're talking a long time, 20 years. It's slow. But we have a lot of management to do in the meantime. Well, it's really interesting, you know. There's been I told you there was a massive amount of money spent in pharmaceutical companies for developing new antibiotics unsuccessfully. And almost all of that antibiotic resistance, antibiotic work was done behind pharmaceutical company walls and never saw the light of day. Because of this, the NIH in the US decided that these antibiotics had lots of money being spent on it. There was no point in spending more money. And so they literally ignored this problem for 30 years. That's why we saw nothing new, because frankly, between you and I, pharmaceutical companies are not the place to invent fundamentally new things. The university is where you invent fundamentally new things, because we have a complete freedom. Those guys, I'll tell you, I feel sorry for my colleagues. Not so sorry I want to join them, but I feel sorry for my colleagues in the pharmaceutical industry. They have a really tough life. They're surrounded by people who all they care about is money, but don't understand that sometimes making money, really involves thinking a bit. So we're allowed to do that. At University, UBC, they understand that. That's good stuff. Yeah, so he's asking about an area that's called ethnopharmacology, and I actually had an interest in it because there's this very persuasive guy in botany named Neil Towers who believes that the ethnic medicines provide tremendous examples to the planet. And it's true, actually, that ethnic medicines have resulted in some active components. Often, I have to say, ethnic medicines have fairly low concentrations of these components. You just use a heck of a lot of them. And sometimes they're weakly active. We actually looked at the ethnic medicines of British Columbian native peoples. And what we did is we had ethnobotanists looking through the archive or through the sorts of things that they use for medicine, decided which of them were antibacterial agents, went out and paid a couple of botany students to collect the plants, extracted things, and at the end of the day, yes, 98% of the plants that we thought should have antibacterial factors in them, because native Indians used it in a certain way, in fact, did have active bacterial components, and 10% of plants that were just randomly selected had antibacterial agents. So ethnic medicine is a tremendous area, exciting area to move into for potential new sources of chemical diversity. And it's not only that, it's a tremendously romantic area to work in, I have to say. It's just scientifically, it's a wonderful area.
We have time for one or two more questions. You've been very patient.
Okay, so the point made was peptides are very broad spectrum. How do they not hurt our cells? Well, there's the darker side of the force. So it turns out that I told you that peptide I showed you, the very first one I showed you, the pretty spirally picture, that was from moths and bees. So in bees, the bee part is actually melanin, which is bee venom. Okay, so wasp venom and scorpion venom are also cationic peptides. So there's the darker side of the force. So the way it's managed in most animals is they compartmentalize the peptide responses. So immune responses are set up so that you can do a little bit of damage, right? Because you're trying to kill bacteria, you may kill a few of your own cells at the same time, but that's not a problem. The problem is trying to contain the infection before it gets to be really bad. George Bush would call it a tactical nuclear strike, right? So the peptides are like that. But we fortunately, when we're in the process of designing, obviously we design out that potential for forming toxicity against human cells. So that's part of the design process. We're screening against human cells to make sure that they're not toxic.
Okay, one more question.
Okay, so I told you actually that, so he's asking me, am I going to help his garden? Is that right? Yeah. So, interestingly enough, the antimicrobial peptides, I told you that they have antiviral activity. And we personally tested them against potato virus X, which is a major potato viral pathogen, and shown we can kill that particular potato virus. So in our wildest streams, we think that they may be effective, but I don't think we'll use them, because one of the real problems when you have something good is using it too often, because nature's really clever at becoming resistant to things. So I believe that if we use it too much, we'll overuse the tool and we'll be back into the resistance era for any new tool that we develop. So we have to pick our spots, use those molecules wisely under the conditions that they're most needed. And I'm sorry, but your garden is not going to take precedence over human beings.
We'll have one more last question. Sorry.
New concepts in vaccine development. There are a lot of concepts in vaccine development that are arising. So my favorite one is you can now clone particular proteins that will give rise to an immune response and overcome an infection into bananas, right? So you can kind of like eat your vaccine. Really, it's a tremendously exciting idea, and there's some wonderful research going on in the States where people have started to try to develop vaccines that are going to be applicable for developing countries, are very cheap to deliver. They do involve those nastily genetically modified things, but this is a good genetic modification, I think, where you try to produce your vaccine in living, edible foods.
Ladies and gentlemen. I'll now invite Indira to thank our speaker.
Thank you, John. Bob, what a spellbinding lecture. We could be here all night. For someone who's had no more than grade 8 biology, I finally understood a whole bunch of important concepts tonight. So thank you on behalf of the audience, and certainly those of us from UBC are extremely proud of your accomplishments. I was really listening to the tour that you gave on antibiotics, the journey actually through time of how antibiotics became to be, plus the resistance that was developed, and the wonderful message with respect to the new strategies that are coming out of your work, and the work of many others really does hold out a great deal of hope for those of us who read the newspapers and fear that the world is coming to an end with antibiotic resistance. So I think it's a wonderful message. So Bob, just to say we are very grateful that you are waging this war against disease-causing bacteria, and I think the impact on global health certainly is going to be enormous. I would like to take this opportunity to congratulate Bob publicly for his just amazing inspiration, creativity, and just incredible dedication to his research, and not just to transform those results from a curiosity in a lab, but also to take them into application and then eventually into applications in terms of new therapies. And I know, although many of you may or may not know, it's certainly Bob's Hancock's pioneering work that has allowed Micrologics to go as far as they have gone to the point of phase 3 clinical trials that will result in a drug that is going to be extremely important in the hospital-acquired bloodstream infections associated with catheters. So Bob has a major role to play in that, and I think we all are very grateful for that. Just to let you know that Bob's accomplishments are many, as was mentioned earlier tonight, he was made an officer of the Order of Canada just this past year, but there's no slowing down. Bob is, as you can see tonight at 9:30, he's ready to go for another 3 hours. And those of us from UBC are extremely fortunate and thrilled to have Bob Hancock as not only a researcher, but also an educator. And I think that that's a tremendous thing about Bob's abilities. Before I conclude, I'd like to thank the Vancouver Institute for allowing us to participate in tonight's lecture series. This is actually the beginning of Research Awareness Week, and here comes the commercial. I promise not to ask for donations, even though our laser pointers don't work. What I would like to do is to tell you a little bit, just a few minutes, of some very exciting events this week as part of Research Awareness Week. And to do that, I would like to call on Dr. Sid Katz, who has arranged the week's events, including collaborating with the Vancouver Institute to organize this lecture. And so, Sid, I'm going to turn it over to you for a few minutes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Indira. I won't keep you long, but I just want to tell you that it's terrific that we've had Bob start our week off the way we have, and I want to thank again the Vancouver Institute for the opportunity to have this collaboration, which I hope will continue over the years. Healthcare is a major issue, of course, in Canada because of the Royal Commission that's going around the country and the fact that we have to hopefully create a healthcare system that we can all benefit from in the years ahead, in particular in the area of new and better medications and treatment. And that's a major theme of Research Awareness Week this year. So I'd like to encourage you to participate in some of the events. The Providence Hospital is having a research day on Wednesday. The Vancouver Hospital and Health Sciences Center is having activities all week at noon hour speakers, poster sessions, and Children's and Women's Hospital is having their research day starting on Monday. So you're all invited to go through, look at the posters, and participate in the discussions. On Wednesday, we're very fortunate that the Royal Commission on Healthcare has accepted University of British Columbia's invitation, and Mr. Romano is actually coming here to UBC. He's going to be here on Monday and Tuesday, and on Wednesday we're going to have an open forum, which I'm going to moderate at Robson Square at 12 o'clock, and it's called Medicare Then and Now. If you were to create a Medicare system today, what would you do? And Mr. Romano will try to respond to that. And we still have seats available. It's first come, first serve, no tickets, and there's no charge. But please come down to Robson Square. If we have an overflow, we'll figure out what to do about it. But that's on Wednesday. And then one other activity that I'd like to remind you of, the Robson Square Theater with our UBC campus will have activities all week. We're having Madeleine Tien and other writers on Thursday at noon. If you know of Madeleine Tien's work, she's a wonderful writer, so come out to that. And also we're having a transportation symposium on Monday at noon where we have members of YVR and also members of the TransLink group to talk about what we're going to do about our transportation problems. There's over 36 events. Visit our website at www.research.ubc.ca, and we hope to see you out. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Indira and Sid. In closing, thank you all for coming. We can reconvene next week to hear Doma Stanton from Michigan. Good night. Please have a safe journey home. Thank you very much.